Good morning and welcome. You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM.
Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
Good morning and welcome. This is Speak Up, your weekly, daily public affairs and news and interview program here on CJSF 90.1 FM. My name is Magnus Thiebald. I'm your host for today. Joining me is Peter.
Hello there, Magnus. I forget her name.
No IU this week, yeah. But hopefully she'll be back soon with another artist feature. Those are quite fun. We have some interesting stuff lined up for the show today. We have an interview with Dr. Ruth Joy about orcas and shipping in the Salish Sea. So we'll be getting to that in a minute. And the shipping we're talking about is big freighters, so it's not going to be an interview about orcas ganging up and sinking boats, as has been circulating on the internet. I don't know if you've heard about that, Peter.
I was a bit surprised. The orcas are attacking ships.
Yeah, it's sort of become a bit of a meme in many places. I have some sympathy for the orcas because there's a lot of boats out there, and not everyone's very respectful to the whales and respects their space. So I could see how they'd get a little.
Well, they don't have any comprehension of what we're doing. So I mean, it's like Moby Dick all over again, I guess.
Although killer whales, orcas are pretty smart. So they say, very social.
Well,
animals.
You know what I mean.
Yeah.
They don't know what our civilization or whatever.
Yeah. So that's coming up in a few minutes. A little later in the program, we have Looking at Lyme and another feature on that. I wanted to talk a bit about events in Russia this weekend, not extensively. But if you were coming in from the previous program, you may have noticed that they spent a whole lot of time talking about Russia and the situation in Russia, but didn't mention this past weekend's incidents in which the Wagner Group, which is a essentially a sort of mercenary force working with the Russians, with the support of the Russian military, kind of rebelled against Putin and turned around and left Ukraine and took over a city near Ukraine in Rostov-on-Don, and then started a march on Moscow. Very dramatic events on Saturday afternoon. I don't know if you were following that on the weekend.
You're filling me in a bit more, but I'm wondering, before the show started, I was saying, have they been caught? Are they in jail, these people? Or?
Well, we'll get to that. So the show we were just watching, Guerrilla Radio, or listening to, rather, Guerrilla Radio, was, in fact, recorded late last week. Was recorded prior to the events of this weekend, which is why they weren't bringing up more about this story. Democracy Now, on the other hand, which is coming up at 11 o'clock today, it was recorded this morning, and I think they'll have a lot of coverage of the weekend's dramatic events in Russia. Just to bring you, Peter, up to speed and our listeners on what was happening in Russia, and we're not going to go into a great deal of detail. But the leader of the Wagner Group, which, as I said, is kind of a mercenary force working with the Russians, although a lot of the soldiers active in the force are primarily Russians as well. From what I understand, a lot of them convicts who were offered essentially parole if they signed up got out of jail, although I don't know if going from jail to a war front is necessarily an improvement in your situation. But and he's been railing against the Russian military leadership for quite a while. I guess because he's somewhat independent of the military command, being sort of a mercenary leader, he's been railing against the military leadership for their conduct of the war, and then just kind of rebelled on the weekend and promised he was going to topple the regime in Moscow, and as I say, took over a city nearby on the Russian side of the Ukraine-Russia border, and then started on a started driving up the highway with a considerably sized force of tanks and infantry and other support vehicles towards Moscow, and was heading there all day, and then in the end, in the evening. Because, I guess with any sort of coup attempt, it's not just about the force you have, but the support you get as you go along. And I guess perhaps maybe that support wasn't there from other Russian military units or whatever. Although he did seem to get a lot of support from people in communities he's passing through. But I guess there's people on both sides of the issue there. You look like you want to say something.
No, I was just saying, the thing about this conflict is that I don't take Putin's side. But I don't quite take 100% the line, the Ukraine, it's a really, it is bad what they did, but there's something behind it. Some people may just say, well, I take Putin's side. There was a reason why he was doing it. NATO was attacking him. I don't take that position, but I think there is a nuanced way of looking at it. As such, without taking Putin's side in it.
Yeah, I kind of see what you're getting at, because I don't, in anywhere support Putin's invasion of Russia or invasion of the Ukraine and a lot of his recent stuff. But I do feel there's, a misstep on the side of NATO and the West in not perhaps leaving a sort of ring of neutral states between them and between NATO countries and Russia, I don't think it justifies, Putin's invasion of Ukraine or his continued policies, but they did have some justification to feel nervous about feeling like they're getting encircled by NATO, and that policy on the part of the West probably could have been better handled.
Yeah, maybe it's sort of people are talking about, they sell their oil to the European countries, but these countries are still buying it, supposedly.
Mm-hmm. Well, apparently they don't entirely have a choice.
And South Africa had the conference of the BRICS,
mm-hmm.
And it's sort of like without it being like the Cold War. Previous to 1992, it's a bit of a Cold War in a sense, because people are collaborating. Like, people are afraid of having the antagonisms go too far. So there's still kind of a strange collaboration across the board, I find,
mm-hmm.
which is sort of like. It's hard to know exactly what to make of it.
Yeah, well, it certainly goes to show that, international relations and international politics and stuff is often very complicated, and the relationship of countries is very much intertwined, Even if Europe wants to just completely get off Russian oil, for example, they don't... they have to get oil from somewhere and somewhere else, and if they can't get it in the quantities they need, they're kind of stuck paying Russia for their oil. And that's
if I could just say something here. When the Cold War ended, 1990, December, I think it was Christmas, 1991, the United States should have really helped out Russia, but it didn't. I mean, one idea, maybe it's a bit too basic, I don't see how it would be, is to say, well, take all the atomic nuclear weapons, and in exchange, we will rebuild your country.
Mm-hmm.
And there could have been some economic exchange over that, and that wasn't even thought of.
No, and instead what they proposed was the rapid transition to a free market economy on very I would, what's the right word, but very pro-liberal terms, which just created a situation where a lot of the existing industry and economy kind of got turned over to a few oligarchs instead of there being some sort of slower transition, and it has set things off
There wasn't really anything wrong with transitioning to free market economy, but they should have got help. Like Germany got help after World War II and Japanese. I don't think there was anything like that. And there could have been a trade. We could have had the Russians not having atomic weapons. And the other thing is that South Africa actually did have atomic weapons. Mm-hmm. When Nelson Mandela came in, he did away with it.
Yeah.
So that was one country that did have atomic weapons and stopped having them.
All right. Well, we got to get on to our planned programming. Just to finish up on, in the evening on Saturday, a kind of deal was brokered that the Wagner Group called off their advance. And that's kind of where the story is, and I think we'll get a real discussion of that on Democracy Now! So stay tuned at 11 for that. They're going to bring in some real thinkers on that issue. Coming up next is our interview on orcas, but first, this quick message.
Hi, I'm ready to go.
You're hiking in that?
Of course. It's such a beautiful day, and I didn't want too many layers because I would only have to carry them.
You do realize these are mountains, right? It can go from sun to snow, and the paths are pretty rough and rocky. Maybe too much for flip-flops.
I'm pretty sure I'm prepared. I saw a picture of the hike on Instagram. Everyone wants to enjoy the outdoors. Just remember the 3 T's: trip plan, train, and take the essentials. Being unprepared could lead you to a situation where you need help, like from the North Shore Rescue, a community-based search and rescue team that provides life-saving services. For tips on how to prepare for a hike, book an info session, or to donate, visit their website at www.northshorerescue.com. That's www.northshorerescue.com.
You're listening to Speak Up here on CJSF 90.1 FM. Recently, CJSF spoke to Dr. Ruth Joy of SFU's Department of Environmental Science and also an adjunct professor in the Department of Statistics. She and her colleagues have been researching and following orca whales in the Salish Sea and looking at the impacts of shipping on those populations. As you may know, the orca populations in our region have been under a lot of stress, and particularly the southern resident orca population. Here's my interview with Dr. Ruth Joy.
And you've been studying the southern resident population of killer whales in the Salish Sea. And we hear quite a bit about the troubles that that population is having, and I guess J-POD in particular. But can you tell us more about this group and the challenges they're facing?
Yeah, so they're culturally distinct and quite unique group of killer whales. And they've had a number of challenges because particularly their summer range overlaps with the busy waters of the Salish Sea. And that's an area that has had a lot of industrial development. It's the Port of Vancouver, as well as home to many other industrial projects down through not just Canadian waters, but down into the US as well. And lots of pile driving and other sources of noise beyond ships. Also a popular location for recreational fishing, commercial fishing, and a lot of other anthropogenic sources of change in the environment. And so the Fraser River, for example, is one of the biggest rivers on the west coast of North America, but it in itself has had many challenges. And how that relates to southern resident killer whales is that their favorite thing they like to eat is Chinook salmon. And with various things that have gone on in the last 50 or so years, the Chinook salmon and multiple different populations that migrate up the Fraser River are also status of, sorry, endangered. So that means their prey is endangered and they themselves are endangered. So it's a tough go for southern resident killer whales in the southern resident in the sorry in the Salish Sea.
So you described them as culturally distinct, I think was the word you used. What does that mean?
It means that there's many different groups of killer whales around the world. They're present from the Arctic down into the Antarctic. And they each group has its own culture. And that means that their language, so to speak, is unique to within that group. And killer whales spend their entire lives with their family and in what we call matrilineal lines. And so there's a strong sense of sociability amongst the killer whales, and it's very fascinating work that others have done that I encourage you to look at. But basically, they spend their lives with their sisters and brothers within a group. The mothers in the group keep with their offspring for their entire lives, and they intermix with other pods, so other matrilineal lines. And so, for example, for J clan, which is what we consider to be the southern resident killer whales, there's three matrilineal lines, J, K, and L. And each of them has some calls that are unique within, or so call types, I mean that by what we might consider to be a word, I guess might be. We don't really understand killer whale language, but something along the lines of they have unique words within each of their pods, but also a shared language amongst those three pods. And those would be unique from, say, the northern resident killer whales, the offshore killer whales, as well as the transient killer whales. And all four of those groups of killer whales are found in the waters off of British Columbia. And each has its own unique culture. Right.
So the clans and groups are matrilineal. So is there mating mixing going on between different groups to maintain to genetic diversity?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. So not between the different ecotypes. So those four groups that I just mentioned, we call those ecotypes or populations. So they're the residents, the northern, it's quite complicated, but the northern residents and the southern residents are called a resident ecotype, and the northern and southerns are considered population. And the southern resident killer whale population is considered endangered. And within that population or clan, there are three matrilineal lines or pods. And those pods meet up into what we call super pods, and there's mixing amongst the different matrilineal lines.
That sounds very interesting. Like, it'd be great to talk more and more about that, but we're actually here specifically to speak about some research you're doing on the impact of shipping specifically on this population.
Right, yeah.
So maybe you can tell us about that. And how does shipping, I mean, you mentioned a bit when you introduced yourself about the various noises, but how does shipping impact the whales?
Well, about 60% of the killer whale's brain is taken up for noise processing. So they have a different way of experiencing the world around them than us. They have eyes, but in the water, you can't see very far. It's dark after a certain depth, and there's lots of reasons why you can't see well underwater. And you'll know that if you've tried to dive down without goggles on. And even with goggles on, you just can't see very far. But sound moves about four and a half times faster in water than it does in air. And it can also move across ocean basins if it's quiet. And so some of the whales of the world will put themselves in particular locations and sing and attract mates. And so sound is an enormously important communication method for all whales, and for whales like southern resident killer whales that have the ability to echolocate, this is how they find their food. And so they make a noise in their using air that's released from an air sac and goes through what we call phonic lips. And those create high frequency bursts of sounds, which we can call echolocation clicks. And when those echolocation clicks hit an object, that creates an echo that then is received back by the whale and creates an image, so to speak, similar to how we think of as bat radar. And so unlike us, they hear with what we think is largely their jaw. And so the entire head receives that sound back. And there's all kinds of innovations that have evolved inside the head of a killer whale in order to be able to process those sounds. And so when you have vessels charging through their habitat, creating noise, for the most part, that sound is at lower frequency ranges. So not within the frequency range of killer whales, but there is sort of a bleeding of noise that goes up the frequency ranges that overlap with both the communication frequency ranges as well. And most importantly, when you're trying to find your food into these higher frequency ranges. So it just makes it harder to find fish.
And so in your research, sort of interesting looking at how you sort of went about it. So I'll ask you about that in a moment. But what you found is that this noise does seem to affect their feeding habits or their feeding times.
Yeah. So I would caution that it's hard to tell by looking at killer whales, because a lot of what happens is underwater. And mm-hmm. So what we've done recently with colleagues down in Washington State has been to position students and whale observers on land to observe whales so that you as a researcher are not causing additional disturbance to whales by being present close to the whales and making noise yourself and also creating physical disturbance by your boat. So we've had teams of observers on San Juan Island, as well as teams of students at Saturna Island in Boundary Pass, and another set of students up at Eagle Eye near Robson Bight on the north end of Vancouver Island, looking at the northern residents. And so what we can see by observing from land is what we think we can see is changes in movement patterns of killer whales in relation to the tracks of boats, as well as we can look at changes in behavior. So it's fairly easy to tell if whales are socializing because they're extremely demonstrative, and it's easy to tell if they're beelining and traveling and not diving deeply, but it's hard to tell foraging. And so some whales are easier than others. Like if they are doing prey sharing at the surface, then that's quite obvious. So southern resident killer whales will share fish at the surface, and they will engage in certain behaviors that are identified as foraging. But there's some uncertainty around identifying foraging behavior. But it seems from the evidence that we've collected that both the noise level of ships, in one of the studies that we published recently, the noise level of ships goes down as the speed of the ship goes down. So we've created between 22% and 40% more opportunities for killer whales to forage by reducing that noise level. And then we've observed that from these vantage point surveys, we've observed that killer whales are less likely to stop foraging if there's less noise observed. So we've both looked at it from the noise perspective, measuring the sound levels on hydrophones, and also looked at it from observations of behavior. And we're sort of trying to make those two lines of evidence come together.
How useful has this research been now? And how much buy-in are you getting from either the shipping industry or the ports around, you know, changing shipping behavior?
Yeah, definitely. One of the projects that we're working on right now with the Port of Vancouver and with the DFO, Department of Fisheries and Oceans, is to forecast killer whale movement. And so we've got a lot of effort put on predicting movement based on historical movement paths, as well as real-time oceanographic variables like tidal state and current speeds. And so to back it up into the historical buy-in that we've had so far is that the first slowdown that I worked on was in 2017, and we slowed all the commercial vessels, or we asked, I should say, all of the commercial vessels to slow down to 12 knots for a 16 nautical mile section of the shipping lane. And this was on the west side of Harrow Strait, or sorry, on the east side of Harrow Strait, on the west side of San Juan Island. And we had, this is from memory, I'd have to look at the paper, but something like 60% of the commercial vessels self-reported participating. And so this is a voluntary slowdown. And this is the way that industry has gone about it to date. There hasn't been a legal action or a mandate coming from the federal government. It has been a port-led volunteer commercial vessel slowdown with buy-in from a commercial shipping industry. And that was in 2017. And last year, I'm not sure, 2021 numbers haven't been calculated yet, but in 2020, I think the self-reported buy-in was over 90%. Of ships were slowing down. So there has been an increase in voluntary slowdowns over that time. There has been an initiative that started last year coming out of ports in the US. So the Seattle port is starting to get on board with making their own changes to shipping routes and slowing down commercial vessels. So I would say that given how charismatic Southern resident killer whales are, there's been a lot of buy-in from industry, as well as you can imagine, there's fear of ship collisions with Southern resident killer whales. That would be like the worst kind of PR nightmare that any kind of shipping industry could wish upon itself. So I think it's a fairly easy sell that everyone cares about these whales, so let's do what we can, has been largely the attitude around anyone who's participating in these kinds of activities in the Salish Sea.
Do you have any sense of how far the impact of ship noise from where it originates affects whales? And is it something that could a lot of help be achieved by the routing of ships? And I know they already sort of travel along lanes already.
Yeah.
But is that a possibility? Is that something that's shown by your research so far?
So I think you're asking how far extent
how far does the impact of shipping noise reach from the ship, for starters? Okay. That's a simple question for starters.
It's not at all a simple question. And I would defer exact calculations to an acoustician, but I can give you some loose answer to what you're asking, and that is that in certain locations without land barriers, the noise of a ship can travel across an entire ocean basin. However, in the Salish Sea, we have a lot of islands, and islands stop noise. So the noise itself, for example, if Harrow Strait, which is the waters between San Juan Island and Vancouver Island, is largely contained when the ship is in that strait within the strait. But having said that, it would fill the entire basin of Harrow Strait. And there's a lot we still have to understand about how noise affects the ability of killer whales to hunt. And so even though the noise fills, noise itself has various different frequency bands. And commercial vessels typically dominate the lower frequency bands. And so killer whales typically use higher frequency bands, but whales like humpback whales and fin whales, they use lower frequency bands because they don't use echolocation. So the relative impact of shipping is something that we're still trying to understand. And I think that's a, you know, and also a species specific. So small animals like harbor porpoise that have very high metabolic rates. So they're spending about 95% of their life